And now Jamie's going to be our main speaker.
Kind of short. Okay. Thank you. Is that good? Or? Yeah? Okay. I feel like if it's too far away, I'm always like this the whole time. And my neck hurts. I'm Jamie. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is February 23rd, 2013. And College Park Triangle is my home group. We meet in College Park, Florida, on Thursdays at 7 at the St. Michael's Episcopalian Church, if you're ever in town. And it's technically Orlando. I'm really grateful to be here. I loved the talk before me. That was awesome. It's a lot of people, so I need a moment. I would have to say, if I could describe my childhood in just one word, that word would be horrific. And when I took my first drink alcoholically at the age of 16, it made all of that horrificness go away, and it was like magic. And I pretty much chased that feeling for the rest of my drinking career. And when I was 16, my brother was getting married, and it was like this big week-long affair and a big wedding, kind of festivity. And my aunt was like, "We're going to like give you your first taste of alcohol, and we'll be here with you, and we'll do this." And I was like, "All right, okay." And I don't know what all that means. And she gave me a 4-pack of wine coolers, and that was a new thing back then. Don't even know if they have those anymore. but they're fuzzy and sweet. And I drank one, and I felt so good. I grabbed the other three. It was a little 4-pack. I grabbed the other three, and I ran into a dark bedroom in the back and slammed the other three in the dark alone as fast as I could. And you know, when I think about that now, I actually heard another speaker sum that up. It's like, if anyone finds out how good this is making me feel, they might take it away. And I can't have that. And I pretty promptly threw up, peed my pants, and tried to seduce my cousin. And, you know, I always say some of the promises that have come true for me is fear of people and economic insecurity have left me, and I no longer try to sleep with my relatives. But the gifts of sobriety, you know. and a few days later was my brother's actual wedding, and afterwards me and my other cousin snagged a bottle of champagne, and we were drinking in her bedroom, and there was this hot guy there. I was 16. He was 35. I don't see the problem with that. And he had a DeLorean, and Back to the Future was really popular. Like, he was my dream guy. And I ended up in the bathroom making out with him, and my dad found out and flipped, you know, and kind of sort of ruined, you know, the reception, the wedding reception, with all this drama. And that guy, a couple years later, I went to prison for trafficking little girls in and out of Mexico for prostitution purposes. And I say that because, like, in just a few days of my first bout of drinking, you know, I puked, I peed myself, and ended up involving myself with really inappropriate and dangerous people. And that is how I drank. Like, that is how I drank the whole time. And when I was also 16, my parents had just kind of had it with me, and they were like, "You need to join the military because you'll never make it." So somehow I conned them into the Army Reserves, and they had a special program where I could go to boot camp in between my junior and senior year. So I joined the Army at 16. I went to boot camp when I was barely 17, and you know, in boot camp, They just give me a really clear direction, like, do this, and if you don't, you'll do 50 push-ups, and if you can't, you'll do 50 more, and I'm a little irrational at times, but it was like clear-cut rules, and it just felt so comfortable, like I was no longer, you know, just like out of the blue, getting my butt kicked for no reason, and I came back from that, and I had self-esteem probably for the first time in my life, and it felt so good. And one night, you know, my stepmom started in on me, and I just lost it and beat her up and ran away from home. And as the Army taught me to fight. And I was living in a Chevy Vega wagon. I think it was about as old as I was at the time. And when I graduated high school, it was a small class. So it was like I graduated number 135 out of 137. And when me and the 21-year-old senior I walked with started walking, like, we got like a standing ovation from the crowd, like, whoa, like, they made it. And I went to my Army tech school, and I met a guy who became my boyfriend because he was old enough to buy alcohol. And, you know, it makes sense. I see a lot of nods. That's awesome. I'm not alone. And we'd known each other for a few months, and we decided that we would continue dating when he got out of school, and I went back to California, and I would come back to Texas when he graduated. And he ended up getting stationed in Germany, and he was like, he called me up, and he said, well, here's the deal. Like, if you want to keep dating, we have to get married. So do you want to keep dating and get married? And I was like, sure. You know, like, Germany sounds better than my life now, and everything always sounded better than my life now. I still can be that way. You know, like, I still have that. And so we ended up in Germany, and I was barely 19. It was like I died and gone to heaven. Like, there's no drinking age in Germany. You have to be tall enough to reach the counter, and I was always tall enough. And in about a six-month period, I was completely suicidal, standing on the Frankfurt Bridge overlooking, you know, the big giant river there, in the middle of the night, ready to kill myself. And it went like that, you know. And I knew about AA because my stepdad was in it. And I started going to meetings, and I was that, like, cute little 19-year-old girl. It just took, like, white chip after white chip after white chip, and I was just, like, sleeping with everyone in the home group. And, you know, married and dating. Yeah. I got married and continued to date. And there was drama. I remember, like, one time, like, sleeping with this other married old-timer, and, like, this other old-timer was yelling at him, and I was standing behind the guy yelling, going, like, call me later. You know, like, I was that girl. And, you know, I say that because when I see that girl, I don't judge. I get it. I get it. It takes what it takes. I came back. We came back from Germany, and I didn't want to date him anymore, so we got a divorce. And I went to Panama City, and Panama City is, like, if you're not aware, spring break mecca of the world. Like, it's insane. There's a club there that holds 8,000 people, and it used to say it's the largest nightclub in the world, and I didn't believe them until I went to a club once in Orlando, and the whole night I thought we were in the lobby. I was like, why didn't we leave the lobby, you know, the whole night? And it was insane, and it was frequently over capacity. And I decided to start taking some classes at the local community college, and made a few friends there, and started a party. And I got a job living with and caring for this elderly woman who was on hospice care. And hospice is a program for people who are expected to live no more than 6 months. So she was pretty sick. And part of my job was to be home every night by 10 p.m. So that I would be available to her should she need me in the middle of the night. And you know that thing they wear around their neck that they press, like, I've fallen and I can't get up? They took that away from her because I would be there at 10. And I remember one night I came home. You know, I started staying out later and later, like 10 turned into 11, turned into midnight. One time I came home around 2 o'clock in the morning, and she had all of her oxygen tubing wrapped around her hand, and her hand was wrapped around the triangle above her bed, and, you know, her hand was purple, and her lips were blue, and she was on a lot of diuretics, so she was soaked in, the whole bed was soaked in urine, and she was crying out for me, and she just kept saying, you weren't here, and I lied, of course, and I said, of course I was here, and you're mistaken, and I wasn't very kind or gentle cleaning her up. And I told myself when I came to the next day, like, I'm never going to do that again. You know, I got to do something. I told my friends, I'm not going out tonight. I'm not going out for a while. And they called that night, and they were getting toasty. They had that sound, you know, like they're toasty. And of course, I'm like, yeah, of course, let's go out. And my solution to the problem with her was I would just overdose her on her Ativan every night and do what I wanted so that she wouldn't end up taking her oxygen off. And, one of my, her son that had employed me, one of my amends was I partied in her house with other people. It was a very small town and people who knew her family. And they had accused me several times of not taking appropriate care of her. You have to be real careful with your amends. You know, get with your sponsor. We don't want to cause more harm. But I definitely had some direct amends to make to him. And he had a nephew who, when he was 16, he got into Harvard. That 4th of July, a drunk driver ran off the road and killed that kid. And so his nephew had been killed by a drunk driver. The nephew's son, father, you know, his brother, never drew another sober breath again. And now he's the lawyer of Panama City. His best friend is the state attorney. And I got to walk into his office and make this amends. And to this day, is probably one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. And I remember saying to my sponsor, like, he's gonna like send me to prison. And she was like, well, that's okay, they have AA in prison too. And not comforting. And I went in there and I made my amends, and he began to cry. And you know, when I was sober, I took the best care of her, and I was like a granddaughter to her. And and at the end of her life, she had mostly lost her mind, but she didn't recognize her family or hardly know who she was. But she knew who I was, and she died holding my hand. And when I went into that office and made that amends to him, I said, is there anything I can do to make this up to you? And he said, you can stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the only thing you can do for me. And every time I would relapse after that, I would think about, you know, how I couldn't even do that. And so I got sober long enough at some point in there to get into nursing school, and it was awesome. And I relapsed between my third and fourth semester of nursing school, and it was crazy. several interesting things happened to me, but it went really downhill really fast, you know. And I remember one morning I woke up and in a trailer, and I, you know, put my clothes on and with some guy, and I was like sneaking out of the trailer, and the guy was like, where are you going? And I was like, home. And he was like, isn't this your trailer? And I was like, isn't this your trailer? And, you know, Panama City problems. And, and I was like, Jesus. So I look outside and my car's like in the front lawn, and he's like, can I get a ride? Well, sure. You know, so he gets in. And I'm like, let me figure out where we are, and it's before cell phones, like, give me a break. And so I, like, figure out where we are, and I'm like, all right, where do you live? And he's like, my God, what day is this? And I was like, Monday, and at 10 a.m., and he's like, my arraignment's in 30 minutes. And I was like, what's an arraignment? And he goes, well, I shot a guy. And the arraignment is where they decide if they're going to lock me up before the trial or let me stay out for the trial. So if they lock me up, you're good. But if they don't lock me up, then I need a ride home. And I was like, all right. So I took him to his arraignment because we've been devoted to each other for several hours. And you got to stand by your man. And so I'm sitting in the courtroom. And, you know, I'm just wearing my JNCO jeans, if anyone remembers. You know, right? Yeah, yeah. From Gadzooks. Yeah, hot mess. And and I've got, like, this little tank top and these huge jeans, and I look down, and, like, I'm just dirty. You know, like, it's just, like, dirty. And I've got, like, mascara down my face and, like, alcohol, that stenchy, nasty alcohol, nicotine smells oozing out of my pores. And I remember this lawyer walked in, you know, and I'm, like, 28 at that time, and this lawyer walked in. She was about my age, and there I am in nursing school. I'm aspiring to be a professional. And this lawyer had, like, a suit on and clean hair and shiny skin. And I remember I had that moment of clarity. Like, I just looked at her and I was like, I want so badly to be like that, but I don't know how to not be like this. Like, I just don't know how. And I continued to relapse and tried the white chip thing again, like more white chips. And was kind of a mess. I was, you know, bounced at, there's like a strip bar in Panama City, like nightly knifings and shootings. It's like that place. And like, I'm 86th for, you know, stripping while not technically employed. And, you know, it was just like, you know, in Panama City, it's a way better story, because when I say I'm 86 from the Gold Nugget, people are like, whoa, like, you know, it's a hardcore. But, and I just went down and down and down, and my friends, you know, looking back, like, they weren't friends. We were all doing the best we could, but they really didn't care if I lived or died. And so finally, one day, I'm sitting in an AA meeting. I've got 2 weeks sober, and this chick walks in, and she's got 1 day sober, fresh out of rehab. And it was like, you know, we fell in love. And she walked in, and I went to my sponsor, and we hooked up immediately. I went to my sponsor, and I was like, I have 13th step somebody. she goes, yeah, 13th stepping is when someone with time gets with someone who doesn't have time. This is just two newcomers hooking up. Don't flatter yourself. And so... So we got together, and I stayed sober for her. You know, she was a great higher power at first. It always is. Love is a drug. And she wanted to come to Orlando to go to school, and I did too. And we came to Orlando, and about 8 months later, I had 3.5 years sober. We broke up, and I'd not been going to many meetings. Again, like, she was my higher power. She would go to meetings and come home, and I would ask her what happened at the meeting and tell myself I'd been to a meeting. Like, not a good plan. And so we broke up, and I drank. And that time, I went to a meeting, and I got a white chip, and a lady put her business card in my face. And the next day I saw, I decided I was going to kill myself, and I'd taken enough cardiac meds. You know, I had enough cardiac meds to do the job right. And I looked down, and I saw my white chip and that business card and the pills and what was my choice to be. And I called the lady instead, sincerely thinking, I'm going to tell her all the reasons why I should kill myself, and she's going to say, absolutely. And what she said is, I'll meet you at a meeting in 2 hours. Can you make it that long? And if you can't make it that long, I'll leave work. And I met her at that meeting, and it was pretty amazing. I just started doing the deal. You know, I had a home group. I was doing service. I had sponsees. Everything was going pretty well. The job got great. I got my second degree. You know, I got my bachelor's. I paid off $50,000 of debt in that time, in a couple of years. And around 5 years sober, I started dating this guy, and I just thought he was great, but my gut knew something wasn't great. And you know, I'm 5 years sober, like, I'm doing fine. I don't need to really listen to anyone anymore. And you know, my sponsor and my good friends were all like, something's really wrong, like, just stop it. And I was like, you don't understand, like, I'm in love. and you just, that desperate need to be loved and wanted, despite what everybody else is and my gut is saying. And we went out one night, and I was violently date raped and by him. And the next day I went, and I told my best friend, and I told my sponsor, and they were like, whoa, like, you know, what's happening here? And they were like, you got to, like, go to the police and go to these other agencies. And he was a bit of a public figure. And I just was terrified. I didn't want to end up in the media and on the news, and I just didn't want to deal. And so I slept on it, and the next day I was like, you know what, I think I'm just angry he didn't call me back. Like, and I'm pretty convincing. When I think a lot of us are pretty convincing people when we need to be. And what happened, I think, in that moment is, you know, when I told that lie. And frequently when I tell lies, I put a block between me and God, and I put a block between me and you, and then I can't see the truth anymore, and I don't get the help I need. You know, I don't think, like, a violent crime is a reason to drink. I think I see a lot of tragic things happen to people in AA. One of the best things I heard last year at a conference, at an AA conference, was just because you get sober and work a program doesn't mean bad things aren't going to happen. But we can stay sober together, and I'll walk through that stuff, I believe. But I didn't do any of that. And in retrospect, I could just see my, like, kind of descent down, you know, into relapse. And at 7.5 years sober, I drank. And That was February 22nd, 2013. And actually, it was about a week before that because I stayed out like a week. Basically, what happened is I was like, I don't think I'm an alcoholic and I think I can drink, because that's kind of like, lies are really believable when we're dry. And I just said to myself, I love AA. These are my people. These are my friends. And if things get bad, I'll just go back to AA. That's not a problem if things get out of hand. And when things got out of hand, I'd had like 10 really strong alcoholic beverages in the course of one afternoon, and I was driving drunk down Orange Avenue downtown with cops everywhere, with a nursing license that I really desperately don't want to lose. And it was like, oh, I didn't think of this, you know. And I thought it'd be easy to come back, right? Like, that's not hard. These are my friends. I love AA. And I think it was one of the single most hardest things I've ever had to do was to come back. And there's something about walking into a room where everybody knows and loves you and adores you, and you're like my tribe, and feeling 100% disconnected and on the outside. Like, it's painful. I don't know why, but it was just harder than walking in here the first time. So if you haven't relapsed, I encourage you to stay sober. So basically I came in and I just kind of laid low for that first year. And at the end of that first year, I just felt miserable. And I was like, what's the point, you know? And I went to a conference with a good friend of mine and her mom. And we, like, started laughing when we got in the car and didn't quit laughing till I was alone in my apartment 3 days later, you know? And everybody knew them. Like, they just, because they do a lot of service, they go to a lot of conferences, they go to a lot of meetings, you know, they're those people. And I was like, I want what they have. Be careful though, because you got to be willing to do what they do. And I'm very tired. but you know, the one lady became my sponsor, and I got a home group. And you know, I always make that part prettier than it is. I got 3 home groups in 3 months. You know, I went to one home group. They completely pissed me off. I bailed on my service commitment and them. I chose another home group. A month later, I walked into College Park one night and just felt like I'd found my people and at College Park Triangle. And I chose that to be my home group. And I had another person as my sponsor at the time. And about a couple months into that, that sponsor pissed me off, and I cursed her out and fired her. And her sponsor is one of the founders of my home group, and she quit talking to me. And I chaired the meeting that night, and I took the seventh tradition, and the treasurer, who's the other founder of my home group, who's a trustee, who sits on the finance committee, he wasn't there, so I was in charge of the money, and I accidentally threw it in the garbage. And he asked me how much it was, and I was like, I didn't count it. I didn't plan on losing it. And, you know, I was in that place where I wasn't feeling too warm and fuzzy there at my home group, and everyone just kind of glaring at me. And I did things like, when it got to the sponsor that I cursed out because I was chairing the meeting, like when it got right before, I'd cut the meeting off, you know, those kinds of things. And one day I'm driving down the road and I'm in all that pain and I'm thinking, what's my next home group? Who's my next sponsor? Got to move on. Time to move on. It's what I've done my whole life. And I had like a major moment of clarity, and I was just like, you know, what would happen if I just stayed? You know, like, I don't know what that would look like. It's not something I'm familiar with. And could I do that? And could I try? And I decided in that moment, like, I'm gonna give that a try and see if something changes. I've been relapsing since 1991. You know, maybe something different could work for me. I'm not sure. And I called the ladies my sponsor now, and she said she would sponsor me. And I've been at my home group now about 15 months, and I've had that same sponsor for about 9 months now, and that's the longest I think I've ever really stayed in anything. And it's been so hard and so painful. Like, I hated having a home group. I hated it so much. I would share from the podium, I hate having a home group. And it's just like, I don't know why we have to do that. And because the thing I hated most about being there is that they loved me so much for being there. And I don't really know what to do with that. And A few months into having the new sponsor, I heard a talk about someone who made an amends right before his wife died, and I hadn't spoken to my parents for a few years. And honestly, like I was dying of an outside issue as well and looking at a lot of things, and I needed some space from them to do that. And I don't think that's wrong. Like, I have cut myself off from them as an alcoholic jerk. That's different, but this was like, I need some space, and I took it. And what I really saw in that time is I got to really look at me, and that was awesome, and see how much was not their fault. But thanks. I called my mom, and she started to apologize to me like she's done my entire life. And my dad left when I was 3, and she couldn't take it, and she kind of lost it. And she was working 3 jobs, and she was exhausted, and she would lock me out of the apartment in a low-income housing project at the age of 3 so she could sleep during the day. And that project was full of, child rapists and pedophiles. And then she married my stepdad, and we moved to Panama City. He was a very violent alcoholic, and I would spend a lot of time outside in a neighborhood where there were just more child rapists and more pedophiles, and that kind of stuff continued for me throughout my whole childhood, and I was angry. And my mom had an idea that some of that went on, and she's always so apologetic. And this time I just, I said, I'm going to stop you right there. I said, you're the best mom a girl like me could ever have. And I'm sick of hearing you apologize, and I'm sick of being angry. So I'd like to just start over right now, if that's okay with you. She was like, yeah, but blah, blah, blah. And I said, from now on, when you think about all those bad things, I want you to just say to yourself, Jamie forgives me, and think about something nice. And that moment that I let her off the hook, I was let off the hook. That's the crazy part, you know? And she said, well, are you going to call your dad? And I was like, shit. You know, don't get along with him so much. And I was like, oh, I can't call mom and I'll call dad. So I called my dad in California, and same thing, told him the same thing. And he's a different person than my mom. And so he didn't get all flowery with me. But he was like, he goes, he told me the story of his childhood, which was honestly far more horrific than my own. I had no idea. And he said to me, I never learned to love children because nobody ever loved me. And he goes, every day I just want so badly to be a better father to you. But the only thing I know how to give you is my best, and I just know it's not good enough all the time, and it kills me. And I just was just blown away by that. Like, and he's my hero today, and we talk all the time, and I'm like, you're amazing. How did I not know this? And I'm going home to see them for the first time next Thursday or next Friday. And my stepdad used to get really drunk and beat the family pets, and I was kind of a nonverbal kid and didn't talk, and they were my friends, and it was a very painful thing for me. And they have a farm, and now when I go home to Panama City, like, he goes out there and one time I was really hungover, and I had some pets that I beat, and I remember thinking, I'm just like him. Like, how did I become just like him? And last time I was out there visiting them, like, he was out there feeding the horses, and I was with him, and the donkey, and the chickens, and the goats, and the parrots, and the you get the point. And, the animals came towards us and not away from us. And just 2 sick and suffering alcoholics that aren't scary today. And that was pretty awesome. That guy's my buddy. And me and my stepmom, we're like old girlfriends whenever we get on the phone. I can't wait to see her too. And all of that is just a miracle and a result of this program. And when I did my fourth and fifth step this time with my sponsor, I did that thing it says to go home and put this book on a shelf and sit quietly for an hour. I don't know if anybody in here sit quietly for an hour. Like, I'd rather do hard labor, like, for days. And I did it this time. And I literally, like, I set a timer, and I was just like hands on the couch, like, an hour, 1 hour. Like, I'm going to do this. And this time around, my fourth step was kind of odd. Like, I just sat down and I started writing, and 5 hours later I was done, and my hand hurt for 2 days. And just God came through my pen and showed me what I needed to see. And in that hour afterwards, you can imagine with my story the kinds of stuff that would come out in a fifth step for someone like me or any of you. And the thing that came to me in that hour was the story I told her, that I'd never really thought of much, and I don't even know why it came out, but I was at the time an adult ICU nurse, and they gave us a kid, and that's weird, but he was going to die as a direct result of actions his parents took against him, and we had the specific equipment and skills required to keep him alive as long as possible, and so they gave him to us. And all week long, he had mom nurses, you know, like, of course, like, you know, give him to the mom nurses, and I was like, yeah, definitely, and the night he went to die, they gave him to me, and I said to my sponsor, I was so angry. Like, why, you know, he clearly needed a parent in that moment. You know, not someone who has no kids. Like, I don't get it. Like, why did that charge nurse do that to me? Because we're self-centered. We think it's all like that. And my sponsor just looked at me and grinned ear to ear, and she goes, you know, do you think you got his situation from his perspective? You know, all the times your parents were too drunk and put you in harm's way and didn't show up. I was like, oh, absolutely. And she goes, do you think that was a comfort to him in that moment? And I said, yeah, I know I was. I know I was. And she just looked at me and she said, you know, what a gift. And when he went to actually die, I called his dad at 3 a.m, who was supposedly sober in recovery. And I said, it's time to come. And his dad was drunk. And that's another thing I was very angry at. And she said, well, then it's just clear to me that God sent a sober alcoholic to suit up and show up and hold that boy's hand that night. And isn't it a great thing that you got to do that? And, you know, that whole situation, like, that whole thing, like, it changed my perspective on everything forever. Like, I take a meeting into the jail, the 33rd Street Jail, to the women there, and I tell my story, and I watch them as relief spreads over them as they hear my story, and they're like, someone else gets it, and she's sober. And when I work with sponsees, and they're like, well, this happened, and I'm like, yeah, me too, and they're, well, then I did this. I'm like, yeah, I get it. Yeah, well, then I did this. Like, so far, I haven't been able to, like, not do that, you know, for everything they say. And to watch them just walk in with their fifth step like this, and to walk out of my house with their shoulders down and looking relaxed, and to give another sick and suffering alcoholic that, you know, it says our darkest past becomes our greatest asset. And I would go through every horrible, awful, bad thing that I've ever been through to be able to give anyone that. And I think that's pretty amazing. You know, from a victim of the world to someone with a purpose, to someone with a primary purpose. And I would just like to end with one of my favorite readings. It's on page 132 in the family afterward. We have been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We have been dealing with alcohol in its worst aspect, but we aren't a glum lot. If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. We try not to indulge in cynicism over the state of the nations, nor do we carry the world's troubles on our shoulders. When we see a man sinking into the mire that is alcoholism, we give him first aid and place what we have at his disposal. For his sake, we do recount and almost relive the horrors of our past. But those of us who have tried to shoulder the entire burden and trouble of others find we are soon overcome by them. So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic experience out of the past. But why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered and have been given the power to help others. Thanks.